You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Hey, Alan, how you doing?
Good, Connor. How you doing?
Pretty good. Why don't I go ahead and introduce us? I am Connor Eccles, the managing editor of Non-Zero. This is, of course, Non-Zero World, the weekend edition of the Non-Zero podcast. And I'm very excited to be joined today by Alan Ayer, who you have a very interesting background. It's great because we're going to be talking today about the sort of crisis between the U.S. and Iran, a bit of the history of diplomatic negotiations, and you were actually a core member of the team that negotiated the initial nuclear deal with Iran. I think you were a member of that team all the way from like 2010 to 2015 and participated throughout that, and of course spent most of your career as a diplomat, and you are now at the Middle East Institute as a distinguished diplomatic fellow. Have I covered the full background? Do you think there's
You've hit everything.
That's all right, well, I'm glad. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time, and there's so much to dig into with you about this. I want to talk about what's currently happening. I want to talk about your experience in those initial talks years ago and how that might inform how we think about things going forward. But first, I kind of just wanted to start off by asking, you know, over the past 3 weeks, it's been a bit of a whirlwind. We had, Israel launching its attacks. Then Trump decides to join in, and then suddenly the Trump administration has pulled back and is saying that perhaps it wants diplomacy, perhaps it wants to bomb Iran again. Who's to say? I guess I'm just curious to start, you know, do you think that there is a path back to the negotiating table after everything that's just happened?
Well, I think there's theoretically a path to the negotiating table, but the more salient question, Connor, is whether you can get an agreement once you're at that table. And there, I think the odds drop precipitously. Iran militarily got its head handed to it by Israel over the course of that war and needed a breather. Israel also, I think, had its own reasons for wanting to stop or at least have a ceasefire. I don't think it achieved all its war goals. So, yeah, I think Iran would like to negotiate for as long as it can under the theory that while it's negotiating, it's less likely to be bombed either by Israel or by the U.S. But I don't think its bottom lines or its red line has changed. Iran still wants to enrich uranium on Iranian soil. And I don't think U.S. red lines have gotten any more lenient. Steve Witkoff, the lead negotiator, had said that because the U.S. uber goal is no nuclear weapon by Iran, that it didn't want enrichment on Iranian soil. There was talks of allowing a consortium of which Iran is a member to enrich someplace else and then to give Iran the enriched uranium, which was a non-starter for Iran. I think if anything, the U.S. goals seem to have become more maximalist. I think there's a perception, perhaps incorrect perception, that Iran will be more flexible because it, you know, got beaten up by Israel and by the U.S. I don't think that holds.
Yeah.
So, yes, there is a path to negotiations. It's theoretically possible you could get an agreement. But don't forget also that Israel, I don't think, wants a deal. So it's quite possible that were a deal to become close, Israel might resume attacks in the hopes of scuttling any negotiated settlement, because I don't think it's achieved all of its war goals yet.
Right. Right. And I should have noted at the top, too, that you speak Farsi. You were the first and only ever American diplomat or spokesman of any kind that did work actually in the Persian language. And I'm kind of curious, you know, you talked a little bit there about Iran. You said Iran does not seem to have softened its position, despite being in obviously a worse sort of military strategic position than it was before. How have you seen that, I guess, in your maybe conversations with Iranians or in the press? How have you seen that play out?
I don't think that having a nuclear program is a hot button issue for most Iranians. You know, this is not the hill they die on. I think the Israeli attack did bring about, you know, a rally around the flagpole effect in Iran, where even people who perhaps weren't supporting the regime, and this is not a popular regime at all, became more nationalistic because their country was being attacked. But the Iran's nuclear program has been a huge white elephant. It provides only about 1% of Iran's overall power, and it's caused billions and billions directly. It's brought about the opprobrium of the international community. It's cost them billions more in lost revenues due to sanctions. So realistically, one has to think that one of the main reasons that Iran has put so much effort into its nuclear program is that it provides them a strategic capability for nuclear weapons should they decide that. But in terms of the Iranian people, I mean, the main point is it's incredibly hard to make any generalizations about any people.
Right.
You know? So I'm loath to say the Iranian people think X, but I think it unlikely that the Iranian people are really keen to preserve their nuclear, you know, power program just because it's a point of pride. But conversely, I do think the attacks, if anything, at least temporarily, strengthen the regime.
Yeah. What exactly, you know, tell me more about why Iran views maintaining its enrichment capacity as a red line. Why is that so important to this government?
Well, part of it is because it gives them the hardest part about building a nuclear weapon is enriching uranium. You know, so the best time to stop a nuclear program from you know, weaponization is before the country learns to enrich. We're too late on that. You know, Iran learned how to enrich 20 plus years ago. So at this point, it's a question of modifying their intentions rather than their capabilities, even though, you know, President Trump has said we've obliterated their nuclear program. You know, Israel has said, not something as bombastic, but basically dealt it a big blow. Yeah, that's true. The nuclear infrastructure has been set back a lot, but perversely, their desire for a nuclear weapon may have increased. But I don't think, remind me, what was your original question there? I think I sort of went far afield.
Well, the original question was just why exactly this is such an important red line, enrichment in particular.
Yeah, I think it's because, to be frank, part of it is sunk costs in the sense that they've put so much diplomatic and political capital into maintaining enrichment on Iran that were they to cede that right, it would be a massive loss of face. And the one thing the Iranian regime fears more than anything else is appearing weak, because they think that invites more aggression from the West. They look at history, they look at the USSR, they look at Libya, they look at Saddam. All those regimes toppled in their minds because they showed they were weak, because they showed they were open to sort of fighting a modus vivendi with the West. And for Iran, Revolutionary Iran's formative experience was the eight-year Iran-Iraq War from 1980 to 1988, where in their minds, no one helped them. They were alone. You know, Iran's dominant sense strategically is that the West is trying to topple the Islamic Republic and they can count on nobody. So agreeing to have enrichment outside the country, outside of their control, is a non-starter for them. They want control. For example, economically, self-sufficiency doesn't make sense. We, you know, we all know about, you know, comparative advantage and so, and how, you know, globalization. The supreme leader of Iran says, I want to do everything economically myself, because otherwise I bare my throat to the wolves. I give someone a chance to sanction me and deprive me of something I need strategically. So a large part of Iran's desire to enrich on its own soil is because they don't trust anyone else to supply them with what they need.
Yeah. Yeah, and you talked about, you said that there was, you know, at least some damage, significant damage to the Iranian nuclear program. I mean, what, do we have a sense of exactly how significant that has been? And even if it is very significant, how long that might set back their ability to pursue a nuclear weapon?
I mean, there's again, you one can't know without battle damage assessment, and in the larger sense, without access by the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, to the sites. And Iran has just passed a law suspending cooperation with the IAEA as a result of these attacks. Now, again, if you're trying to build a nuclear weapon, you need centrifuges that are spinning. Iran still has those, even though the two main places where there were banks of centrifuges have been destroyed. And that might have probably has, you know, put offline the centrifuges that were there in Natanz and Fordo. But doubtless they have centrifuges elsewhere. They already have a large supply of enriched uranium and some highly enriched uranium, which is the essential component for a nuclear weapon. Again, there's sort of there's great uncertainty as to how much enriched uranium and highly enriched uranium Iran has access to now. So that's another strategic ambiguity. And you also need a way to change, to sort of weaponize that uranium. And that also is where there's a lot of uncertainty, because the factory where that could have been done has been destroyed. But who's to say they don't have other facilities elsewhere? The key point is that Iran's nuclear program is vast, decentralized, and has a lot of redundancy. Okay? So without full Iranian cooperation with the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, there's no way of knowing. And that lack of visibility is what is so threatening. You know, the intelligence community assessment was that Iran wasn't seeking to build a weapon before Israel attacked. This wasn't a preemptive attack in any way by Israel. It's just, for a variety of reasons, this was the optimal time for Israel to do it, right? So they did it. Right. But now that we're lost a lot of visibility, we still have overhead, right? Israel still has lots of, I think, sources of intelligence, spies, other ways of assessing what's on the ground in Iran. But there's no doubt that this attack and the subsequent lack of suspension of cooperation with the IAEA has really decreased our visibility into Iran's nuclear program. And, you know, when you distrust an opponent's motives, that's a bad thing. You know, if we lose visibility into another nuclear program where there's no doubt about it being thoroughly peaceful, that's less of a stress. But before the attacks even started, the IAEA found Iran in non-compliance with its obligations as a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And the director general said, because of the lack of visibility into Iran's program, I cannot certify Iran's program is exclusively peaceful, even though I have no evidence of any weaponization.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious, how limited was the verification during that period where they had sort of pulled back a little bit on their cooperation with the IAEA? Obviously, now it's completely in the black, but, you know, what did that look like before?
Well, I mean, what started things off on a downward trend was when President Trump pulled out of the JCPOA, okay? They did that, and then Israel, because it hasn't been confirmed, but probably, you know, what at least mass media or conventional wisdom ascribes to Israel, Iran's main nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated. As a result of that, the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, passed a bill decreasing Iranian cooperation with the IAEA. There's a thing called the additional protocol that allows inspectors to do more in terms of inspections. They stopped implementing the additional protocol, and they increased their enrichment from like under 5%, which is really all you need for a nuclear program, civilian, to over 20%. And there's no need for 20% enriched uranium. And, you know, toward the end there, before the war started, they were at 60% enriched uranium. No civilian need for that. So President Trump's withdrawal from the JCPOA started a chain of events that decreased cooperation with the IAEA. Iran, I mean, there's like the vast majority of the world's countries are members of the NPT. And Iran is pretty much the one where the IAEA spends its most efforts investigating and inspecting. Again, most countries don't have a nuclear program, so that's to an extent to be expected. But it's Iran has never fully cooperated with the IAEA. And as a result of that, even before they decreased cooperation after the JCPOA pullout, that led to real questions about whether they had a weapons program. The U.S. intelligence community said that up until 2003, Iran had some aspects of a weaponization program, which they stopped in 2003.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question. I mean, something I've been thinking about in these past couple of weeks is that, you know, these facilities where one does a lot of the enrichment, they're huge. They are big targets, right? Or where you turn that enriched uranium into uranium metal for a weapon. Those are big. Yeah. But I'm kind of wondering, like, other types of weaponization efforts, if they were to pursue them now, especially with us having less visibility. I mean, are those at a much smaller scale? I have to imagine they would be.
Yeah, Connor, that's spot on. Here's the key point. Before the attacks, it is overwhelmingly probable Iran wasn't trying to weaponize. If they decide to weaponize and build a weapon, they don't need to rebuild all the stuff that was blown up, right? They just need it's a much smaller, more focused, less expensive effort to weaponize. So they don't need to rebuild Fordo or Natanz, right? Iran has plenty of mountains for underground sites. They got, you know, earth excavation equipment. So if Iran decides to weaponize, it doesn't mean they have to rebuild everything. They don't. They could just, I mean, they are already clearing earth and I think trying to dig out Fordo and Natanz. But it's, as I said, a far more focused, probably shorter in terms of duration of time, less expensive effort. If they say, okay, we'll try to rebuild the strategic stuff, but let's focus on building a weapon. And again, we'll have far less visibility because even though primarily, I assume, U.S. and Israeli intelligence are keenly focused on this, we lose the main organ of perception, which is the IAEA. And don't forget, it's a ceasefire. Israel has said, if we see anything we don't like, we're going back in there. And because they've taken out so much of Iran's air defense systems, that's a lot easier.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, even Trump is saying similar things now, floating the idea of new airstrikes. It doesn't seem like a particularly suitable environment for more talks, but who's to say, I guess.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's very interesting. I'm curious, the talks that were actually happening, right, before the strikes happened a few weeks ago, you know, what was your assessment of those? Were those generally on the right track? Was there a chance that they could succeed?
I mean, there's always a chance, but I think the word I would use is desultory, you know, in the sense that, first of all, Iran said, well, we can't negotiate directly with the U.S. because we don't trust them. So we have to do it through a mediator, Oman. That makes no sense. Lack of trust versus trust doesn't dictate whether I talk to you directly or through someone else, right? There is no trust in international negotiation. That's why you have verification measures. So that was silly. And then for the U.S. side, you know, Steve Witkoff, I'm sure, is an incredibly capable person, but he's got Gaza, Ukraine. He's got the, you know, this portfolio. The Trump administration has decimated expertise in the traditional foreign policy institutions to include the State Department, to the NSC. So there was less expertise brought to bear on negotiations. There was less time. They met a couple of hours every week or so for five times. And I don't, you know, without any sort of focusing on text. And that's important. I'll tell you why. You know, the first part of a negotiation is you can talk, broad outlines, come to general agreement, right? At a certain point, it's all draft text, you know, because writing it down and getting people to agree phrase by phrase, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph. I'll explain it this way. As you mentioned, I was on the nuclear negotiating team for 5 years, right? For the first two or three years, we were spinning our wheels, much like Steve Witkoff was doing now, because we wouldn't talk directly with the Iranians. They wouldn't talk to us. So we had an intermediary who was the EU, you know, head of foreign affairs. We'd gather every couple of weeks. First of all, we spent a long time arguing with Iranians about where to meet because they didn't want to meet an entity country that was sanctioning them. So it would take a lot of time and effort to determine where to meet. Then you'd meet. You'd have these plenary sessions where people sat around a table and read their speeches, right, that had been written beforehand. Then everyone would sort of go to their control room and have, you know, meetings, even though, as I said, the U.S. wouldn't meet Iran. Nothing much got done. Also because Iran didn't want to negotiate. But when President Rouhani became elected president with a mandate to get sanctions lifted, which meant negotiating as part of the, you know, the international P5 plus one process, then we met far more frequently. We had big teams. We talked directly with the Iranians. You know, we stayed for days and days on end. There was one time, I think we were in Vienna for something like 2 weeks, nonstop, every day. Steve Witkoff and the Iranians never got to that point, okay? They were still, I think, talking general principles. They might have, at the end, passed, written texts. So neither side gave diplomacy its best effort before the attack started.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, how does that... You said, obviously, there's no trust necessarily in these types of negotiations. That's not the principle you start from, of course, because your adversaries are not on the same page. But I'm curious what it looks like to sort of build trust between people in a room, right? But when you're in these sorts of negotiations, like what is the experience of those direct negotiations that makes it more helpful than indirect ones in terms of just the actual interpersonal dynamic?
Yeah. That's a good question. I'll tell you, it's funny. I remember once when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she said, "We don't want to talk to the Iranians just for the sake of talk." And I thought to myself, well, that's not actually true in the sense that talking about anything just builds circuits of communication, right? It gets you in the habit of talking with a country that you haven't talked to for decades, right? So when the U.S. and Iran finally started talking person to person, face to face, you know, I used to say diplomacy is not a sufficient condition for reaching a solution, but it's a necessary one. You know, it is not the case that Wendy Sherman, who was the head of our negotiating team and the single most effective diplomat I've ever seen, you know, she's talking at that point to the foreign minister Zarif. It's not like she's showing pictures of her grandkids to Zarif, who's showing pictures of his grandkids, and they're like, "Oh, I guess we're all the same after all," you know? No, the U.S. and Iran had substantive, real differences that interpersonal relations couldn't help, right?
Right.
But just the habit of talking, it's like a Petri dish. It's like a catalyst. It sped things up. It made it more quicker, okay? So if you're meeting every day, if you're talking, you know, a lot of it is like in the beginning, Iran has this serious, what's a good way of saying this, grudge against the U.S. You know, if you listen to the Iranians, they say, "Oh, you know, you Western imperialism tried to control us, tried to control our resources, overthrew Mossadegh in 53, did this, did that." And so just, you know, in the beginning, that was the first part of any discussion, right? This whole litany by the Iranians of "you did this, you did this." And then once they sort of drained that and got that out, then we got to business, you know? So diplomacy, I mean, kinetic action doesn't work, okay? I mean, the Israelis can go back and mow the grass, as they say in Iran, you know, in the hopes of perpetually pruning Iran's nuclear program, which they might well do. But that doesn't get you to a long-term solution. Diplomacy gives you a chance, but let's not forget, it's really hard. You know, we've been circling Iran and Iran had been circling us for decades. And we had this one window in the Obama administration where both sides made it a priority. And so it worked out one time. But that was rare. And I don't think those conditions exist now, which is why I don't think even if both sides give it a shot, the odds are good.
Yeah. Yeah. So your general assessment is still that. I mean, I am curious, I guess, you know, what was it? You said that both sides sort of felt open to these actual talks at the time. I mean, the U.S. and Iran have both at least said that they would like to talk at many different times throughout the years. The Biden administration claimed to be doing this. The Trump administration, you know, actively claims to be doing this in some ways and way on back as well. So I like what made that situation so unique?
On the Iranian side, it was President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad did such a horrible job running the economy, he drove it over a cliff. I mean, he could have been a Mossad agent for all I know, in the sense that just his combination of incompetence and corruption was such that it really put the Iranian economy in a hard place, right? So the Iranians agreed to negotiate. And it was the first time, so they didn't have the experience of what happened subsequently of President Trump pulling out for no reason. And the fact that when they did the JCPOA, this tsunami of Western investment that would lift the Iranian economy didn't happen, right? So this is why recreating the JCPOA is tough. President Trump pulled out for no good reason in the minds of the Iranians. And even though there was serious economic benefit, it wasn't the order of magnitude the Iranians were hoping for. So that's one of the reasons why the Iranians did it. Why the U.S. did it was because, unlike every other president, in my opinion, President Obama said, I'm going to make our Iran policy, or at least preventing Iran, this nuclear deal, the independent variable. It used to be that Iran policy was the dependent variable, yet the consequence of our Israel policy, our Gulf policy, the executive branch's policy with Congress, right? So all of those relationships normally dictated our Iran policy. What President Obama said is, not out loud, but it seems he said this, is that, look, I'm willing to break glass. I'm willing to irritate the Israelis. I'm willing to irritate the Saudis. I'm willing to irritate the Republicans and many Democrats in Congress by trying to get a nuclear deal with Iran, because we have to take the Iranian nuclear threat off the table. And so that was his priority, right? And a lot of stuff got sacrificed to that. But presidents before and after, like President Biden afterward, he wasn't willing to do that. President Trump certainly isn't willing to do that. So that's what made the difference. I think that unique combination of factors.
Yeah.
And Iran felt in control of its own house. Right around the time Obama became president, you had the Green Revolution, right? And so for a long time, you know, the U.S. was doing a policy review on Iran, and Iran was busy putting down this problem. You know, they arrested the speaker, they arrested the former prime minister. So Iran also has to have its internal house in order in terms of it feels politically secure, which is something else that's not happening now, which is another reason I don't think diplomacy can happen.
Right. Right. So in a sense, I mean, it's a bit bleak, right, as far as assessments go for today, I guess. It really seems as if none of the conditions are in place for this to work out, even if suddenly Trump were to turn around and say, hey, we're willing to come back and do sort of sincere direct talks or something.
Well, it's still the case. I mean, Iran's economy is worse now than it was before, right? So they could certainly use the boost, the economic boost, were sanctions to be lifted. So I don't want to say no conditions are in place. Iran's economy is horrible. And they, if sanctions were lifted, which is a big if, because sanctions are so much easier to impose than to lift. But if U.S. sanctions were lifted, that could be a real boost to Iran's economy, even without any U.S. investment. I know at one point, President Trump said something about U.S. investment in Iran, you know, visions of Trump Hotel in Tehran or whatever. The Iranians don't need that. I don't even think they want that. They're very concerned about increased U.S. presence in Iran, this regime. But they would like, you know, fewer sanctions just to, I mean, if you look at the price of the Iranian currency, every time there's negotiations with the U.S. before the war, it went up, right? So there is an economic motivation for Iran to reach an agreement. The problem is they're very concerned that if they relax on their red lines, that's like chum in the water, drawing the sharks who are seeking regime change in Iran.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting balance that they strike with their sort of desire to appear strong, I guess. I'm curious how you think about this, because when I looked, for example, at their response to the Trump administration's attacks most recently, it was, you know, in many ways quite mild. They seem to have warned the U.S. ahead of time. They seem to have hoped that it wouldn't really do much damage. It might have even been more mild than what they did in response to the assassination of Qasem Soleimani in 2020. And so, you know, how do they square those two things?
Well, again, it's you're exactly right. Their response was a cookie cutter copy of their response to Soleimani, which is it was de minimis, minimal. They telegraphed it beforehand, you know, very few missiles. They told the Qataris, they told the U.S. They felt they had to do something, but they certainly didn't want to engage in an escalatory spiral with the U.S. because they really don't want the U.S. to cooperate with Israel militarily in Iran. And it worked, you know, so good on them. But the other part of that is, you know, the domestic messaging is, you know, if you remember during the U.S. war in Iraq, they had Iraq had a communications minister. I think they called him Baghdad. We called him Baghdad Bob. Who, you know, even when Schwarzkopf was just ripping up the Iraqi army, he would stand at the podium and say, you know, we've driven out the Allies. We've crushed them. General Schwarzkopf is weeping at his pillow. I mean, just ridiculous hyperbole. That's sort of what the Iranians do. You know, if you listen to, as I do, you know, Iranian military rhetoric during and after these attacks, what the Supreme Leader has said, it bears no relation to reality, you know? So that's what they do, is that they, you know, the Iranians, I mean, there's a saying in the fact that, you know, no military or no government in the Middle East ever lost legitimacy because they lost a war. You know, Iran, I'm not saying they're fine with losing, but they have a PR construct that allows them to package taking a beating and keep on going. So they did what they always do, which is they took a beating, they tried to give as good as they got, but they couldn't. And then they're trying to sell it domestically as a victory. How many Iranians believe it? Probably not that many. But, you know, this is the apparatus that's set up. It's getting, you know, and this is another topic, progressively weaker over time.
Right. Right. A bit of a different topic, but I'm curious to get your take on this. Maybe I should have asked about this earlier. But the stated actual policy of the Iranian regime, of course, is that they will not seek a nuclear weapon, that they actually don't have an intention to do so, and even that it might be religiously wrong to do so. To what extent is that credible, and does it even matter if that's credible?
You know, we paid lip service to that when we were negotiating before. I mean, the Iranians say that Ayatollah Khamenei has issued a fatwa, religious ruling, saying that weapons of mass destruction are haram, prescribed according to Islam. Don't forget that, you know, Iran has the experience of being victims of weapons of mass destruction during the Iran-Iraq war, where the Iraqis used chemical weapons and sarin against them, right? So, and the world was totally silent, by the way, which was another formative experience for the Iraq people who do Iran strategy. In terms of whether we think that's binding, no, of course not. You know, a fatwa can be changed any time. Again, the whole point of negotiations is not to negotiate based on intentions, but on capabilities. So, yeah, I mean, we weren't going to, in negotiations, say, oh, so you issued a fatwa, we're done here, you know, thanks a lot. No, this is why, you know, any agreement that we come to, the spinal cord is robust verification, mostly by the IAEA. So, you know, Iran always says that. What's interesting, though, was before this 13-day war, for like the last 6 months, you know, when Israel was killing IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps members in Lebanon and Syria, and really upping the pressure on Iran, what was interesting was you had people affiliated with the Supreme Leader, like the former Prime Minister Kemal Khatami, say, yeah, you know, we have a fatwa saying we're not going to use nuclear weapons, but, you know, if Israel keeps, you know, if Israel attacks Iran, or, you know, if things change, we might have to revisit that issue. So for the first time publicly, there were influential Iranian policymakers openly brooding the idea of seeking a nuclear weapon.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. And one thing that comes up here, and that's sort of a through line in, I think, how Iranians are viewing all of this, it would seem, is that there's lots of sort of violations of norms and laws that they feel have been done upon them, right? That you talked about the Mossadegh overthrow in 53. There's also, you know, chemical weapons widely banned, widely, you know, when Syria used them, obviously, there was wide international condemnation. We had less of that from Iraq. And in fact, even, you know, the U.S. was in many ways involved in Iraq's chemical weapons program in its earlier stages in some ways. So I guess how does all of that, because, you know, this latest strike in many ways is likely illegal under international law, I think widely believed to be so, the latest U.S. and Israeli strikes. I mean, how important is that in sort of the Iranian strategic imagination?
Yeah, it's determinative. Again, Iran thinks that international law is a pretext, a fig leaf, that the West uses it what it wants to and ignores what it wants to. Things like human rights in Iran or the NPT. Yeah, you know, Iran looks at the chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq war. When a U.S. naval carrier blew up an Iranian civilian airliner, killing, you know, hundreds of Iranians, right? There was no huge outcry. And in fact, according to the Iranians, they noted that the guy who was in charge of that naval carrier got an end of tour award.
Mm.
You know, so that's another point. There's all sorts of, like, the NPT, they think, is a double standard. So there's tons of data points the Iranians will always marshal to say, the U.S. uses international law when it wants to. For example, the situation in Gaza. You know, the Iranians have been strident about the injustice of what Israel is doing in Gaza and how it violates international law. They, you know, like many others, refer to the findings of the ICC, International Criminal Court. But they also point to the silence of the U.S. in terms of not denouncing Israel. So, yeah, for the Iranians, international law is a flagrant double standard, and they don't trust international law to protect them when the West comes looking for.
Yeah. It's an interesting balance they strike, though, because you also have, you know, they'll participate in it. They'll participate in these international institutions that are obviously sort of part of it. And they'll even through all of this, they've obviously limited their participation with the IAEA, as we've been saying, but they haven't yet left the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So I guess, I don't know, it's just it's an unusual balance. It's an unusual balance they strike.
And they're very good at it. I mean, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who was the former foreign minister who did the JCPOA, he spent much of his career in, you know, at the UN. They always know how to use the international community or try to use it to register their point, you know, asking, you know, why hasn't the IAEA condemned Israel's attack? You know, why hasn't the Security Council condemned Israel's attack? So they always at least check the box by referring to the relevant international fora when they feel Iran's rights have been transgressed. But again, because of, you know, great power politics, it's rare and they almost never win the day. But they do think it's important to keep using international fora and international organizations to press their point diplomatically. I mean, the current foreign minister, who, when I was doing the negotiations, was the deputy foreign minister, again, is very, very adept, Foreign Minister Araghchi, at the art of diplomacy, of using not just UN organizations, but other international groupings to make Iran's point.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe this is a good time to come back. I want to sort of dig more into your experience with the JCPOA negotiations and how that might bear on all of this. But I'm also just curious at a sort of general level, like, what about the actual process? And I'm talking more about the direct negotiations once you were all in the room together. What about that is you think, different from how the public might imagine a diplomatic experience? Like, what does it really look like? Are you kind of, you said you have text and then you're going line by line. Like, what is that process?
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.